Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with next Tuesday's election in Israel that is likely to bring back a right-wing government in coalition with a far right-wing party that will be increasingly out of step with the largely liberal American Jewish community who support Israel. A government with a more combative relationship with America's president, who already has trouble dealing with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Gideon Levy, a journalist and member of the editorial board of Haaretz, joins us from Jerusalem to discuss Israel's march to the right. Then we'll hear a speech that President Obama will not give at Monday's inauguration, but should. Paul Ehrlich, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and professor of population studies at Stanford University, joins us to speak about how climate change is baking Australia and flooding America's East Coast, and that climate disruption will wreak havoc on our food supply already heavily dependent on greenhouse gas-producing fossil fuel. He calls for a new Manhattan or Man on the Moon project to address global warming that the president should enunciate before it is too late. Then finally, Sam Tannenhaus, the editor of the New York Times Book Review, joins us. He's the author of The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences, and we'll discuss how much President Obama's second term might be rewarded by the growing fratricide within the conservative movement between the Tea Party talk radio base of the Republican Party and its less ideological corporate and managerial class. And joining us now is Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is a former spokesman for Shimon Peres. He is the member of Haaretz's editorial board, and his writing is highly praised and noted for its keen analysis, insight, and understanding of the Israeli as well as the Palestinian perspectives. His latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much.
And Tuesday's elections look like it's going to be a triumph for the Israeli right. It's possible that the new party of Naftali Bennett, the Jewish Home Party, may win as many as 17 seats, which is as many as Likud is supposed to win. So that would be a right-wing coalition government, would it not?
Yeah, no doubt it will be a right-wing coalition government. Maybe some center-left parties will join it. And no doubt that Naftali Bennett is the black horse of those elections. By the way, it's not a new party. He just took it over. It's quite an old party who changed its name and, above all, changed its leadership.
And he used to work for Netanyahu, did he not, Naftali Bennett?
Right. He worked for him, and it ended quite badly, both with Mr. Netanyahu and with Mrs. Netanyahu. But all the involved parties don't like to talk about it.
Well, there's an extensive profile of Naftali Bennett in the current issue of The New Yorker by the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, which is a lot of people over here found quite disturbing. There is obviously a disconnect between the direction that Israel is heading in terms of its politics, and Israel's supporters over here in the United States, particularly amongst Jewish Americans, who are predominantly liberal. And in the last election, in spite of all of the money that people on the right over here, the casino owner Sheldon Adelson and people like that, gave in support of Israel to the losing candidate, nevertheless, in this last election, Jewish Americans voted, I think, about 75% for Obama over Romney. So is this a disconnect that's going to grow, where you have a liberal Jewish American polity in the United States that supports Israel, and Israel is moving further and further to the right?
First of all, I'm not sure that those who voted Obama and are considered to be liberals in the United States are also very liberal when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian dispute and the policy of Israel and the settlement policy and the occupation, because then they tend to support quite blindly and automatically the Israeli government and the Israeli occupation. So not everyone who supports Obama in the United States is also supporting the liberals in Israel. There is still a gap. But, Israel is voting for its own leadership, and the United States is voting for its own leadership. And not always it comes to the same point. And as we know, both Mr. Obama and Mr. Netanyahu do not get along, and the gap is really deep. The question is, will the Jewish community of the United States, and will, above all, the administration of the United States, stand against the policy of Mr. Netanyahu or not? And this is still an open question.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic apparently has made a claim that Obama basically has said that he doesn't want Netanyahu to be re-elected, and that the relationship between Israel and the United States at the top level is dysfunctional. And I'm wondering whether that is a part of the current debate. My understanding is that a lot of Israelis are concerned that this relationship between Israel and the United States is more important than their leaders, and they don't want necessarily to have a leader that's going to make that relationship dysfunctional, because after all, it's pretty clear who Netanyahu wanted elected. He clearly wanted Romney elected.
This is all right, but your assumption that Israelis are concerned about it is unfortunately wrong, because the fact is that the majority will vote for Netanyahu or for the right-wingers, which guarantees bad relations with the Obama administration. Unfortunately, Israel turned to become, in the last decade, more and more nationalistic. And unfortunately, it goes also with caring less and less about the world, caring less and less about the attitude of the world. It's not only the United States, it's almost the entire world now. And Israel is really disconnecting itself from the international reality.
And I guess the entrance of this new, young, multimillionaire, pro-settler party led by Naftali Bennett, that's further to the right of Netanyahu, has already pushed him to the right, right? Netanyahu's just saying now that he will not dismantle any settlements. So I guess you can already, that's a preview of where this government's heading, right?
Absolutely, but we don't need a preview. We have the last 4 years, which were bad enough in terms of the peace process and any kind of efforts toward any kind of settlement with the Palestinians or toward putting an end to the occupation. The next government most probably will be even worse than the current one.
And all of those former senior military and intelligence leaders who've come out of the closet, if you will, and have spoken out against what they consider to be Netanyahu's reckless militarism, and also the former Likud leader, Ehud Olmert, has been absolutely outspoken in his criticism of what he considers to be Netanyahu's reckless leadership and warmongering. None of that has resonated, or at least sufficiently so, to stop this right-wing sweep.
Unfortunately not. All those topics and others that you mentioned were quite exposed here to the Israeli public opinion and had very, very little effect. Unfortunately so. All those signals coming from the outside and from the inside did not influence the majority of the Israeli public opinion.
Again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz. He's a former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and he's a member of Haaretz's editorial board, and his writing has been highly praised and noted for its keen analysis, insight, and understanding of the Israeli as well as the Palestinian perspectives. His latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. So I was just wondering, though, in terms of, you know, that there was an alternative, Gideon, to AIPAC over here, the long-standing Israeli-American Political Action Committee that's often referred to as the Israel Lobby. There was a left-wing version of it, or a more progressive version of it, called J Street, that's sort of trying to get some traction. That's what I think most of our listeners over here in the United States are interested in, is what is going to happen, do you think, to support for Israel from the majority of American Jews who are more liberal than the AIPAC is it, can it reach a point where it's going to be unsustainable? Or do you think that it'll just be a kind of Israel right or wrong, and liberal American Jews who support Israel are just going to have to swallow this reality? Or is there anything that they can do to influence the political direction of Israel?
Let me be very frank with you. AIPAC is not a genuine friend of Israel. AIPAC creates much more damage to the future of Israel than a part of the enemies of Israel do. Because AIPAC supports the occupation and AIPAC supports blindly and automatically any Israeli government and mainly right-wing governments. And people like me had a lot of hope when J Street just came to the scene, to the arena. But unfortunately, you know about it more than I do, J Street does not gain the same power, the same influence that AIPAC has. AIPAC is still very, very powerful, and we can see it in the daily political life of the United States. The question is much less what will the Jewish community say. The real question is what will President Obama's administration in its second term say, because let's remember the first term of Mr. Obama was very disappointing in terms of the Middle East. Obama could have done much more to put an end to the Israeli occupation, and he did very little about it. And the big question is now, will Obama the second be any different than Obama the first? Will he change his policy? Will he be more involved? Will he be more devoted? Then there is really a lot of place for hope, because Israel is so depending on the United States like never before. And no Israeli prime minister, will he be as right-wing as he will be, will not be able to stand against an American devoted president who will really decide to put an end to the Israeli occupation.
Well, it hasn't ended, and it's been increasing over the decades, and the goalposts have been consistently moved. Do you think a forthright American president who puts a line in the sand would be listened to? Netanyahu's already just said that he's not going to dismantle any settlements.
Netanyahu can say whatever he wants before the elections if he will face a devoted administration, and a very tough one. He will have very little choice, because militarily, diplomatically, politically, morally, economically, Israel is so depending on the United States that all those big words will become very little if they will face a real, as I say, devoted American attitude to really once and for all put an end to the Israeli occupation.
Now, what is happening vis-a-vis these rumors about the Palestinian-Jordanian Confederation that was floated by King Hussein's brother, the uncle of the current king, and others? Is there anything happening in that arena that could change the political dynamics in the region? Obviously, Iran's loss of Syria, which seems all but inevitable, is going to have an impact. But let's start with these rumors about a Palestinian-Jordanian confederation. Is there anything to that, do you think?
No, I don't think so. This is really the language of the past. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, this could maybe be a solution, but not anymore. Jordan declared long time ago that it is not interested in governing or controlling the West Bank. The Palestinians are devoted to get an independent Palestinian state. They deserve it. The big, big majority of the world supports it. And I think that you can't now go back 20, 30 years ago and talk about confederation, because this is not what the Palestinians want. This is not what Jordan wants. And it's much too late for this.
Well, apparently it's always been a kind of, you know, right-wing fantasy that somehow the Palestinians will go away and slink off into Jordan. And that's why the former King Hussein never wanted to bring it up. But it is being brought up in some quarters, but there's nothing to it, in other words. That's the bottom line.
Absolutely. I mean, the name of the game now is either the two-state solution or the one-state solution. There's no other real settlement.
And what do you think about the possibility of the loss of Syria? I mean, Iran losing its proxy, if you will, in Syria. I imagine Israelis are quite concerned about who will take over from the Assads. And the indications so far are that they're going to get a government, if they're lucky, about as friendly as the new government is in Egypt.
Yeah, but there is very little that Israel can do about it. Israel is watching carefully what's going on in Syria, but Israel cannot influence it in any way. And nobody knows how will it end there, but really nobody knows. And I don't think that this is fatal. The fatal issue, the main issue, is the relationship with the Palestinians and the creation of a Palestinian state and the end of the Israeli occupation. That's the main issue. All the other issues, as important as they are much more marginal than this one.
Right, but your point is, Gideon Levy, that will only become a real issue in as much as there've been a peace process forever, and there's never been any peace. Things have actually gotten worse and worse since Oslo. And I mean, there was a period, it's worth reminding our audience, then, when Israelis were going to casinos in Hebron and buying furniture in Bethlehem and traveling all over the West Bank. Those days are over. You're saying the only way to really get serious is for a powerful and committed American push in the direction of a Palestinian state. Otherwise, the agony is going to continue to get worse, right?
Absolutely so, because Israel and Israelis don't care much about the occupation. They pay very little for the occupation. They know very little about the occupation, and they discuss very little the occupation. You know, the occupation was a non-issue in this campaign to the elections, which will take part on Tuesday. And I don't see any hope for change from within the Israeli society. It must come from the outside.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is a former spokesman for Shimon Peres. He's a member of Haaretz's editorial board, and his writing is highly praised and noted for its keen analysis, insight, and understanding of the Israeli as well as the Palestinian perspective. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how global warming is cooking Australia and flooding America's East Coast. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Ehrlich, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University. He's a fellow at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Ehrlich.
Nice to be here.
And a large part of the continent of Australia in the middle, there's a huge pool of hot air that's been hovering there now for some weeks. And every time it moves slightly in one direction or another, wherever it moves, it creates bushfires. And now it's just moved a little bit towards the city of Sydney that experienced a all-time record-breaking heat on January the 18th of 114.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Clearly, global warming is alive and happening in Australia. Why do you think we're not really hearing too much about it over here?
Well, I think we call this the Murdoch high, the Murdoch heat, because here, for example, the false news network, Fox News, is basically forbidden by Murdoch to even discuss climate disruption. There is a very well-funded program, funded largely by the fossil fuel industry, to confuse people about the whole issue of climate disruption, and to make it seem like there's a lot of scientific differences and that it's not really a serious problem. And if it is a serious problem, it's not human caused, and that's all hogwash. I think of all the people in the world, Murdoch has probably done more to mortgage the future of our children than virtually any other human being by continually through the Wall Street Journal, the Australian, which is a rag in Sydney you may be familiar with, and so on. And, of course, when you have friends out there, I was talking to friends in Westleigh, which is a northwestern suburb of Sydney, the other day, and they're not far from a bush reserve, and they have all their valuable things packed and by the door because they're sufficiently worried about the huge number of bushfires and the chances of more coming along. And, of course, they had to go through that day of something like 114 degrees of heat. So Australia is seeing the tiny little edge of what's going to happen in the future. The idea that this is a sign of the future is wrong. That is, at the moment, we are still adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere at a very rapid rate. And the kind of thing that's happening in Australia now is a tiny foretaste of things that are going to be much worse. Just like in the United States, Hurricane Sandy isn't what's going to be happening in the future. Things much worse than Hurricane Sandy are going to be happening in the future.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Ehrlich, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University. Now, of course, these conditions in Australia are not only making the continent uninhabitable for humans, but its spectacular biodiversity is being affected. I was reading recently a piece in the Guardian for their reporter down in Australia, pointing out that some of the people that he knows that have farms, and these are not in the hot inland, but more towards the coast, the normal agricultural area of Australia. They're saying that the droughts are so severe that these 300-year-old gum trees died of thirst, and then suddenly the rains come and they violently strip off the precious topsoil. So it's
a grim picture.
And it feels like nature is, you know, Gaia, if you will, is writhing in agony and trying to tell us something.
Well, this is exactly what the climate scientists and the computer models have shown. More extreme weather. It could be that suddenly Australia will have a cold snap. We're changing the entire pattern of circulation and patterns of precipitation over the entire globe. Our agriculture developed in an unusually stable period of climate on the planet, the last 10,000 years. It's now moving out of that regime, and the most serious problems that humanity is going to face are not going to be sea level rise, which will probably only affect, at least in this century, a few hundred million people. It's going to be changing patterns of precipitation and extreme weather and droughts that are going to clobber agriculture, and that could easily affect billions of people, and that's what we should be really worried about, and we should be pushing the idiots like Murdoch aside and starting to move on this, at least in Australia, which is vastly overpopulated and an already marginal continent as far as the environment is concerned. At least there's discussion of population size there. In the United States, of course, we don't even deal with the issue, even though in terms of climate change and wrecking the planet in general, we're the number one culprit.
But Australia is exactly the same size as the United States, minus Alaska, with a population of under 20 million, I believe.
Slightly over 20 million, love Australia. Yeah. I've seen much more of it than the average Australian. I've been in every section of the country. It is not a rich continent in terms of its productivity. Its soils are poor. It's got not enough precipitation where it needs precipitation. It hasn't got really big rivers. And if you've ever been to the end of the Murray Darling, you know, but it hasn't got enough water to barely reach the sea most of the time. Australia, you can't judge the ability of an area to support people by its area alone. After all, the moon has got a lot of area on it, but we can't live on the moon. We can't live in the middle of the oceans. And Australia is, in one sense, a poor continent. In terms of its biodiversity, extremely interesting plants and animals that are being wiped out now at small and no small cost to humanity. But Australia is also, instead of becoming a model, showing, for example, with its superb solar scientists that it can run Canberra largely on solar power and then selling the solar technology to China and India where it would really do some good, Australia is still exporting coal. Australia seems to have, and again, it's my second home and a country I love, it seems to have the urge to become a third world country and make most of its money by simply exporting unprocessed its mineral products. And that's ridiculous.
Well, it's been referred to as China's quarry. And it's interesting to note that while Australia is going through this agony with high temperatures and bushfires, China, at least its biggest city, people can't breathe the air.
China is in a terrible position. I was recently a guest of the academy there, and going into Chengdu, going into Xi'an, you see them putting up hundreds of high-rise apartment buildings to try and take care of the hundreds of millions of people who want to move into the city. They all have low ceilings, no cross ventilation, that are designed for air conditioning, and yet you can't breathe the air because the coal they're burning to generate the electricity to make the to run the air conditioning is making it virtually uninhabitable. And when they can no longer do that, of course, the apartment buildings will be uninhabitable because there's no way to keep them cool enough for people to live in during the summer.
So just to deal with the politics of Australia, because the politics of China are so opaque, except that we can say that there's a little bit of disarray at the top with the Communist Party leadership, and there is a possibility of some more liberal succession happening later. And certainly the country is much, much more wired, and the internet is roiling with a lot of activism. They just got rid of the Chinese Communist Party censor. The activists online caught him paying off an employee for sex. So there's a lot happening in China bubbling beneath the surface, but it's difficult to quite predict. But Australia's politics are pretty straightforward, and unfortunately, the Liberal Party, which is the Conservative Party down there, is a mirror of the American Republican Party in as much as their anti-science, know-nothing Tea Party types seem to dominate that party. And they're in bed with the big extraction industries of coal and iron ore, etc. And lo and behold, it looks like they're going to win this next election in spite of what's happening to the environment.
It's really terrible. And the thing is that Australia has got superb ecologists, superb environmental scientists, maybe per capita the best in the world, but the Australians aren't listening to them. And that's a huge, huge mistake. They should be listening to Dick Smith. They should be listening to Dick Smith. They should be listening to Bob Carr. There are people in Australia who know what the world situation is like, what Australia's situation is like, and would try and do something about it. But as long as the Murdochs and their, you know, his idiot friends are in charge, you're going to have the same kind of problems we have in the United States, where we are the most overpopulated nation in the world. We are the one that's wrecking the world's environment more than anyone else, and yet, in our past presidential election, there wasn't a single important issue even discussed. So Australia and the United States are sort of bound together by stupidity at the moment, and it's up to the citizens of both countries to get it changed.
And in both cases, the evidence is manifest that climate change is underway and that we're going to have more and more of these extreme weather events. And what's going to happen, though, in terms of forming a kind of alliance, if you will, against the deniers, which are largely the coal companies and the fossil fuel industry, who are pumping money, and of course they've got the propaganda arm of Fox News? They're obviously being effective in terms of maintaining a level of denial about the reality of what's happening to the planet. But on the other hand, surely people in the insurance business, there's a reckoning going on there, surely.
Oh, yeah, Swiss Re and other companies are extremely concerned and speaking out about it. But the well-funded propaganda from the right has been extremely effective. 30 or 40 times the amount of money is going into that that's available to try and tell the truth. And, of course, the scientists are stuck. They've got to be honest. They've got to say what they think the situation actually is, whereas the Murdoch gang is perfectly free to lie in its store teeth continuously and does it. And so it's think that it's a scientific debate is a mistake. It's a street fight where one side has to fight with only truth and one arm tied behind its back, and the other side can fight as nasty as it wants to, and it wants to.
But usually, though, plutocrats sometimes change their mind when it hits home. In his home country of Australia, surely he must know, Murdoch, what's happening there. And I know they have properties and farms and stuff. And somebody's got to be telling him that the continent is boiling.
Well, I think actually Murdoch at one point has said he does believe that the climate is changing and that human beings are doing it, but he doesn't put it through the Wall Street Journal, which, by the way, is a good newspaper except for its editorial pages, which are run by morons. The Australian occasionally has some honest stuff in it, too. You wouldn't believe it. So there is some hope. But again, I think the real hope, and we're pushing on this very hard as we can within my community, of trying to get a social movement going that is going to try and force the government and the plutocrats to actually do things that are in their own best interest, but they don't really figure it. In other words, it's high time that people like Murdoch started thinking about their grandchildren and great-grandchildren and what kind of life they're going to live instead of trying to increase their already swollen bottom line. One thing is really critical is the issues that are now in the public debate in the United States about debt and not much of the world, debt and debt ceilings and so on, and fiscal cliffs. That's all nonsense. For every nickel of debt, there's a nickel of credit somewhere. That problem can be entirely solved by negotiation among human beings using pencil and paper and computers. You can't negotiate with nature. You can't say, well, we're going to blow through an increase of 2 degrees Celsius around the planet, but you're just going to have to let us grow our crops when we're at 5 degrees Celsius above today's temperature. Can't be done. No way to negotiate with nature. We have got to remember that nature controls, and if we don't change our ways, it will change our ways for us, whether we like it or not.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, though, again, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University, and also an adjunct professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. In many ways, ground zero for plutocrats is Wall Street. Wall Street got its feet wet with Sandy, the hurricane. And my understanding is that New York is going to have to invest billions and billions to sort of become like Amsterdam, protected by seawalls. Again, is that coming home to roost?
You would think it would. I mean, you got to remember that even in normal times, there are hundreds of pumps that have to be kept going all the time to keep the subways from flooding. That's how low New York is. And if you lose electricity, you lose the pumps. The subways flood, the foundations of the skyscrapers start to rot, and the whole damn thing comes down. And so if they're not concerned about sea level rise and climate change, they sure as hell better become concerned soon. We need the kind of mobilization that we got during the Second World War. We have huge, huge problems coming down the pike. We have 85% of our energy coming roughly from fossil fuels. That should be reduced to something like 40%, and that's a horrendously difficult task. We have to re-engineer. Our infrastructure is crumbling, but we have to not only re-engineer it and repair the water handling infrastructure, we have to rebuild it for flexibility so that water can be taken to new areas where water is needed. In other words, our present patterns of irrigation and so on are not going to work as the climate changes. And so we really need a mobilization, but few people even realize the problems out there. Most people think their food comes from supermarkets. They have no idea, for example, that the agricultural system puts something on the order of 30% of the greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, And, of course, it's agriculture that is most threatened by climate change. We are utterly dependent on fossil fuels for our food, and yet we cannot, we're basically killing ourselves, or at least our grandchildren, by burning the fossil fuels. So we're in a really tight spot that almost nobody recognizes. I mean, of course, the scientific community has recognized it for a long time and spoken out on it for a long time, but we're in the middle of the endarkenment. You know, we're moving away from evidence, running our society on a basis of evidence, and we're starting to run it on a basis of faith. Lots of luck.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, I wish that President Obama at his inauguration on Monday would make the speech that you just made. Of course, on Sunday, he was sworn in for a second term. We know that he's a great speechmaker, but as you pointed out earlier, in the last election, global warming was barely mentioned. If we need another sort of Manhattan Project or Kennedy vowing to get a man to the moon and back, if this is the moment we're in, what can we do to get the president? He's our only leader at this point, to get him on board and get him to recognize it. You're talking about just one aspect of it, which is to reduce our dependence on fossil fuel from 80% plus down to 40. I don't know what time frame you mean, but
ASAP, as fast as possible.
Right.
And Obama has been informed in all of this stuff. And of course, but he has a bunch of idiot advisors, you know, 35-year-old English majors who don't understand anything of how the world works, who keep saying you got to do it this way, that way, that way, if you want to get reelected. Okay, they got him reelected. Now there is no excuse. Obama has got to get out there and say that the Congress has totally blown it by not doing anything on climate change, that we have other extremely serious environmental problems that are never even mentioned, like toxification of the planet. We have very dangerous chemicals now spread from pole to pole. Losing the biodiversity that runs our life support systems is absolutely essential to agriculture, becoming more and more vulnerable all the time to epidemic disease, and fighting resource wars that could easily turn nuclear. Particularly, for instance, India and Pakistan might have a nuclear war just over the fact that the water supply that supplies their agriculture is going to be reduced as the Himalayas melt, as the snow and ice of the Himalayan plateau melts. These are all gigantic problems we should be working on, and it's going to be up to Obama to actually do it. He's got the brains, and he has the knowledge, but I'm not sure he really gets how serious it is.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
And nice to talk to you. Good luck.
Thank you.
And wish good luck to Australia.
Well, good luck to all of us, I say.
That's right. Take care.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Paul Ehrlich, the president of the Center for Conservation Biology and a professor of population studies at Stanford University. He's a fellow at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the conservative crack-up here in the United States.
So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand. No, just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand. No, just won't understand.
I think you're crazy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sam Tannenhaus, who's the editor of the New York Times Book Review and a former editor of the Week in Review section of the Times. From 1999 to 2004, he was a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where he wrote often on politics. His work has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, the New York Review of Books, and many other publications. His book, Whittaker Chambers, a biography, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Tannenhaus.
Hey, good to be back on with you.
And Sam, there's a very provocative piece by David Brooks that appeared a few days ago that's got people chattering. It's almost like a blueprint for the Democrats to whip the Republicans. And he calls it, actually, the kill the wounded strategy. So it's a very odd to have a conservative giving the Democrats a blueprint how to destroy the this already fratricidal party. Do you think that the president's second term is going to be rewarded by this growing fratricide between within the conservative movement, between what David Brooks calls the Tea Party talk radio base of the Republican Party and its less ideological corporate and managerial class?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's been going on for a long time, and I think the real confirmation, the wake-up call for the party, especially the people at the top of the party and in the conservative movement who are aligned with it. You know, the people like David Brooks, who's not so much a movement type as some others, but who is has a history in it, is, this last election. I think many on the right, Irving Kristol and Charles Krauthammer and people like that you'd see on Fox Television and Karl Rove and others really had persuaded themselves that they were going to win this election. They could not imagine how Obama would win. And I think what surprised them was not only the size of the victory and its sweep, which although, you know, it's not a landslide, but remember, this is, many people have said this is the first Democratic president since Franklin Roosevelt to win two successive terms with more than 50% of the vote. This is the first president in either party since Reagan to do that. I mean, this is a more successful president in terms of his popularity than any president since Reagan. That's why another New York Times op-ed columnist said Obama is the liberal Reagan. He has that kind of command and support. The numbers aren't as huge, and this gets to part of what we're talking about, because what we're really going through is a demographic change in the country that hasn't reached fruition. So there's enough of an opposition base, which is essentially a white male gerontocracy, to stop Obama a little bit, and that's what we see in the House of Representatives and such. So they can still obstruct him fairly well. What he has is about as close to a mandate as a recent president has had. One area where I would quarrel a little bit with David, whom I so often agree with and always respect, is he describes a lot of the issues coming up, gun control, immigration, as wedge issues meant to divide the Republican Party. Well, they're a lot bigger than that. I mean, these are the issues that matter to a lot of Americans. So Obama's success in getting some kind of legislation through an amnesty program or reform of immigration, some kind of limitation on this absurd and terrifying gun violence, those aren't just defeats for the Republican Party. And that's progress for the country. And it's important to see them that way, too.
But Sam Tannenhaus, it's a bit ironic, though, to think that what Karl Rove thought was a winning strategy to use these very same wedge issues to rile up his base and to roll over the Democrats. Now David Brooks is saying, telling the Democrats they should be using these same issues against the Republicans.
That's the big surprise, Ian, is that the culture wars, which were so successful and profitable for the Republican Party, really for a 20-year period from 1968 through 1988, when they won election after election, with the exception of a near win even after Watergate, those cultural issues have now turned against them. same-sex marriage, immigration, ideas about race and gender and ethnicity, abortion, contraception. These issues are now the third rail for the Republican Party. And for a long time, they feasted on those. And what happened was, it was interesting in the last election, Romney, who was, you know, more or less a disciplined candidate, time and time again would insist that the election was only about the economy. As soon as he was caught off guard, what does he start talking about? Minorities and women and students and all the gifts that are lavished on them, the 47% of the unproductive moocher class and all the rest. These became such mainstays of conservative ideology that they can't get past them even now. And so what happened was, that's why I mentioned demographics before. You know, even a few weeks, you may remember, before the election, big publications, Washington Post for one, ran the article we get used to seeing every 4 years, which is, why can't Democratic nominees do better with the white working class? How can they possibly win if they get only 40 to 40% of the vote? Well, Obama got even less than that, and it didn't make any difference. That is a minority now. That's what they still haven't wrapped their minds around, that their party is a shrinking, dwindling one. And this is what I wrote in the book you mentioned, you know, a few years ago, that this movement has really ended. It's reached its end point, and they don't know what's next. And so Obama, if he's smart, and the Democrats, if they're smart, will seize the advantage to push through the legislation that most of the country seems to favor anyway. They'd be silly not to do it.
Again, I'm speaking with Sam Tenenhouse, the editor of the New York Times Book Review and a former editor of the Week in Review section of the Times. His latest book is The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences. But there is a difference between the parties in terms of their combativeness and their resolve, if you will. When George W. Bush essentially got elected by the Supreme Court, he wasn't in any way embarrassed by his lack of a mandate. He charged ahead as though he had a mandate. And then, of course, after 9/11, he used that in many ways to push through a very aggressive agenda for which he was not elected. So compare that to this president that you just described as having been the first president since Reagan to have won over 50% in two successive elections. He has a real mandate, but he's never acted like he did in the first term. And do you think he's going to be more assertive in this second term?
Well, he seems to be so far. He drew the line on this upcoming debt ceiling battle. I mean, he just pushed it to the margins. He said he would not compromise. They backed down. He is, I'm told, by journalists who've talked to him very recently in interviews that haven't been published yet, much more partisan than he used to be. And he was during the campaign, too. You'll remember after he won in an early press conference, I think it was when Susan Rice was brought up, when that nomination was first floated, he was very direct about saying he'd won this election, and also when it came to negotiating over the Bush taxes, he said he reminded the Republicans he had run on this and would stand by it. And yeah, he gave a little bit of ground, but he got a lot more than he gave up. That's why, you know, the Republican House group, you know, almost just kind of fell apart at that point, and then finally had to push through what was essentially his proposal. So I think, you know, his nature seems to be conciliatory, partly because he was a law professor, and to try to find areas of agreement. But I'm told he strikes a more partisan tone now, which is not unusual. If you look at second terms and also the campaigns that incumbents run, in preparation for those second term, they tend to be more rather than less polarizing, because once you've been in office for 4 years, you can't so much be the kind of all things to all people candidate, which Obama was the first time, and most candidates are the first time they're out when they're first nominees. But so I think we will see more of that. And I think he's also lost patience and now sees that because he was reelected, there's enormous confirmation in that. And I have a feeling he will be quite aggressive and not afraid to go after what seems to be a weakened party. And I think that's what Brooks is writing about. Charles Krauthammer had something about this, too, that was much more defensive, as he tends to be, about how Obama was kind of unfairly picking on this this weakened party, kind of a silly argument. I mean, he won an election, and Republicans have been extremely aggressive, as you say, for many, many years now. But I think that there also is a kind of anxiety among the Republicans. Bill Kristol is supposed to be putting together some sort of organization or, you know, a group that modeled, they say, on the old DLC, the Democratic Leadership Committee, that's going to try to moderate the Republicans. And National Review, the conservative journal, is organizing this massive summit next weekend, 3 days long. We're going to work through all the arguments and debates. They're just starting from scratch now. They now know what they never quite acknowledged in 2008 is that they're beaten. And so Obama may not even have to push all that hard. People like Paul Ryan are already kind of maneuvering. Marco Rubio, Jindal, the ones who think they have a future in national politics are already moving away from the Tea Party group. He may not have to push all that hard. There'll be the one group in the House that will resist, mainly from the South, some from some of the kind of, you know, libertarian mountain states and such. But for the rest, I don't think they're going to give him a whole lot of trouble.
Right. And Chris Christie, of course, has already moved way to the left of the party.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, he jumped ship early on.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't think then that this is a sort of repudiation of Karl Rove's strategy of creating this gerrymandered majority that he's got, you know, because one of the disturbing statistics of the last election was that the Democrats in the House got more votes than the Republicans did, yet the Republicans have considerably more seats. And those people that Rove engineered the election for, basically, they're more afraid of a primary challenge than they are of being out of step with the nation. So is that... I mean, it would seem to me that the real challenge Obama has is he's got to run in 2014 as though he ran in 2012. And normally in the midterms, a president doesn't take an active role. But it seems to me that this is the time for the Democrats to take advantage of disarray within the Republicans and really go for wiping them out in the House.
Well, I think you're right about 2014, though. That'll be difficult because of the districting and redistricting, the gerrymandering. Some of those seats will be very hard for Democrats to win. That's how they were set up. Also, of course, as you know, you get much lower voter turnout in the off-year elections, and that always helps the Republicans. You know, they tried to make it happen again in 2012 by, you know, through voter ID and all the rest. Yes, you're right. If the Democrats can make a strong surge, I mean, it's something like, 17 seats or something, which doesn't sound like all that many, except for the fact, as you say, that they're so tightly packed. These packed districts make it very hard to make any sort of inroad. But if they do make a really concerted effort, and if Obama has some successes, and also it'll be a question of where the economy goes. I mean, one reason the Republicans were so sure he would lose was because unemployment was so high. It didn't make any difference or made very little. If the economy actually starts to pick up in a noticeable way, Democrats could make some serious gains. But still, it will be really, really hard for them to do. I think you're quite right about Rove, by the way. I mean, that was the plan. You know, after 2000, which, as you rightly point out, the Democrats actually won. You know, Rove and company just made a point of getting more evangelicals out in 2004. You know, that's how they got their guy elected. So it's always been sort of, you know, working these particular bases they have. Those bases are not really there for the Republicans in national elections, but now they may be in congressional elections and also state elections. They still do pretty well, you know, in state houses and such. And because we have a more kind of balkanized culture, you know, state by state and also nationally. So those majorities are going to be hard for even a popular Democratic president to get until we've passed through the next phase of this demographic shift, I think, where there are more and more Latinos voting, a larger Asian population, where if the Republicans continue to be really extremist on the social issues, drive more and more women away, they're going to have to, you know, majorities will get built out of different blocks now. And so it may take another cycle or two before the Democrats really get there.
Well, just in the last minute, Sam Tenenhaus, up until 2014, how is the president going to govern? Can he keep this coalition that he found to get around this fiscal cliff impasse? In other words, push bills through the Democratic-controlled Senate to the House and get the House to do an up or down vote, because there's usually with the Democrats and enough wavering Republicans, he can get bills passed. Otherwise, it's gridlock.
Yeah, and it's going to be issue by issue, I think. You know, I mean, I think he does have these, you know, these signing laws, which I don't like. I think most people who are, you know, still invest some kind of authority in the Constitution don't love it, though presidents have been doing it more and more. And if that's what he has to do with a gun law, that's what he will do. Apart from that, I think it will be issue by issue. I think David Brooks is right, that immigration is going to be a lot tougher than he thinks. There will be real resistance to that in the Republican base. And David, I think, is right that Obama can demonize a lot of that vote, a lot of that support, but you're still going to have a big enough group that's going to make it hard for many Republican legislators. So I think it will go issue by issue. Healthcare is done. That's there. And by the way, you know, some credit on that, I think, goes to Roberts. I think that was the beginning of the shift in this last election cycle, was when Roberts took that issue away from them, which is also a sign that he, who is smart, after all, and has a sense of history, knew how out of line it all gotten. That if you have a massive piece of public legislation that makes it through both houses, and the opposition, however intense, is not an overwhelming majority, there's just no reason on earth to overturn it. So he had to let that go through. And so if Obama is clever, and he seems to have learned a lot,
right,
I think he'll be strategic with each of these issues one by one. And see where the majorities are.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sam Tenenhaus.
My
I appreciate it. Again,
all
I've
right,
been speaking. Bye bye. Again, I've been speaking with Sam Tenenhaus, the editor of the New York Times Book Review and former editor of the Week in Review section of the Times. His latest book is The Death of Conservatism: A Movement and Its Consequences. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.